Hello and welcome to the One Stop English podcast for July 2017. Each month we bring together teachers, editors and experts to discuss what's going on in the world of ELT. I'm your host Sam Wadsworth, former teacher and current editor here at Macmillan. Joining me this month are Becca Sanderson, former teacher and editor of numerous general English and business titles.
Hi Sam.
Sean Roberts, TILEC qualified teacher and primary editor.
Hi Sam.
And Claudia Salazar, English teacher at the Instituto Panamericano in Morelia, Mexico.
Hi, Sam.
This month we'll be discussing narrative contextualization and principled eclecticism. We also have part one of an extended interview with Carol Reed, award-winning author of Tiger Time and 500 Activities for the Primary Classroom, specialist in primary language teaching, and former president of IATEFL. Okay, let's get started. Sean, you're going to tell us how to use narrative structure to plan your young learner classes.
Yeah, so narrative contextualization sounds fancy and complicated, but the idea is really straightforward. Combining basic narrative structure and an age-appropriate context to plan a lesson and create a fun, memorable class. What do I mean by basic narrative structure? Any ideas?
The whole lesson is like a story, and you weave in bits of grammar and vocabulary. Mm, yeah. The class is like an experience rather than different sections.
Is that about right?
Well, it's towards that, yeah. Oh, okay. The whole lesson does take the form of a story, but we take the parts of a story to plan it. So what I mean by that is having a beginning, an introduction where you set the context of the class, a middle, which is first a problem which needs to be resolved, and then the resolution of that problem through learning language, and finally, the end, where you review the class, both the context and the language points that you've covered.
Okay,
so could you give us a real example from a classroom?
Sure. So I've done this before with a class of 10 to 12-year-olds, and the context was a pirate class.
Mm-hmm. Arr!
Yeah, okay. Exactly. To start with, to set the context, the children finished pirate hats that I prepared and personalised them, and then I set the story of a pirate treasure hunt. And the language aim was prepositions of place. What was the problem? Well, another teacher in the school, Captain Redbeard Craddock.
Oh, I know him well.
Or David Craddock, if he's listening. Had hidden his treasure somewhere in the school. And I split the kids into red and blue teams and gave them red and blue clues. To resolve the problem, the children had to solve the clues they were given to find words hidden around the school, which made up one final clue.
Oh.
And this led them to the treasure, and also a preposition check.
Wow,
so
yeah.
The context of the lesson, mm-hmm, and the language of the lesson are combined in that whole class plan.
Sounds right. Like lots of fun.
Yeah, this sounds like a lot of fun. Actually.
It's quite chaotic fun, yeah, with kids running around the school. But yeah, why do I think you should try this in one of your classes? Why do you think this might work?
I think students would be a lot more engaged. They'd get caught up in the story and forget their learning. I think they'd just really enjoy it. What do you think, Claudia?
I believe that it is very important to know which kind of activities you have to use with the young learners. And these kind of activities, I think they are very creative, and they also improve their creativity with young learners.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, creativity, engaging, fun was another word we used. Those are all great reasons. I think in ELT teaching in general, we try to provide a context to make learning easier for our students at any age. We do this because it mirrors how learning naturally takes place in your native language.
Right, Sam? Yeah, I was going to say that really it's nice because it puts the language in a context. It might not be a particularly authentic context in that, you know, it's pirates, but you're learning the language kind of in a more natural way, in a more natural setting than perhaps just from a sort of text that you read or something.
Yeah, and I don't think it has to be a completely realistic context, because as long as it's something that they recognise, and that's when the age-appropriate part comes in,
right,
then it provides a kind of framework for them to hang their new language on, any new language that they're learning or practising in the class.
Mm.
So if I already know the context of what we're talking about, it's much easier to understand the class and to learn much quicker the new language that you're learning. Also, as well, we've spoken about fun and creativity. I think that all primary teachers would recognise that children love stories, and they're very familiar with this kind of arc, beginning, middle, problem and resolution. And so why don't we harness that imagination and love of stories that all of our students have?
So here's a question. Adults love all these things too, don't they? Is it possible, do you think, to use this kind of technique in an adult class? Obviously with a different theme, you know, zombies or some kind of outbreak.
I think it's possible. I don't know if you'd want to do it every time. It could get a bit tedious for the students, right. You know, like constantly tapping into their imagination. It's not just not quite the same mindset as a child.
Is that not true, though, of children as well? I mean, how often would you recommend doing this? How, because obviously it seems like it's quite a lot of work to prepare it. So you presumably couldn't do this every day.
Well, firstly, to speak about adults are much less willing to play the game in class than younger children are.
Definitely can be, right?
Maybe some people have classes of adults that they think this would be appropriate for, but you have to really know your learner in that case. I've never done it with an adult class.
Right.
In terms of using it in every single lesson, no, you'd lose the impact and you would create a lot of extra work for yourself because our course books and most schools' courses aren't built around narrative contextualization classes, right? So you'd have to constantly be adapting all the work that you've already done. And I'm a big believer in teachers giving themselves less work to do rather than more in their planning.
I mean, one way that could help that is presumably if there are teachers that have done this successfully. This probably exists, but somewhere that you could upload successful lesson plans and you know, kind of say, I use this text or this book, and here is the staging. I think that would be really useful.
Yeah, well, I'd love to see something like that. I don't think it exists right now. There are some examples that you can go and see. There are some interviews with teachers who've done this at the British Council that you can see and see how they got on. But I don't think there's a kind of database.
I would like to ask you, what's with the high level? This kind of activity also, they want to use their imagination and creativity in a different way. How can you change this activity for higher levels? Do you think that works also about the price for higher levels?
Good question, Sean.
Yeah, well, actually, one of the issues with the class I did was, as I said, they were 10 to 12 years old, and that's quite a big age range. Some of them were definitely more into dressing up and running around as pirates than some of the others. You're almost hitting kind of preteen with some of the students in that class. Mm. The context is important for age. I mean, you could pick any level of language point from complete beginner to advanced, I think, as long as the context is right for the group that you're working with. And I think that's the most important thing to take into account when you are planning this type of lesson.
Mm-hmm. All right. So to wrap things up, have you got any tips for anyone listening that really wants to go out and try this?
Well, we spoke about selecting the right context. I think that's absolutely crucial. Also, I'd say commit to that context yourself. The kids won't engage if the teacher doesn't set an example in this type of class, and be prepared to laugh at yourself if necessary, or at your colleagues like Captain Redbeard.
Right. So don't drop out of character.
No. If you do break the spell and act like now we're going into normal class mode, get your books out, that will kill the narrative completely. Once you've set that narrative, maintain it for the entire class.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Sean. Becca. I understand that mixing up your methodologies is the best way to keep young learners engaged.
Yes. Well, I imagine a high percentage of our listeners will have taught or are teaching young learners. And I think it's safe to say teaching children comes with its rewards and its challenges. Would you agree, everyone?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah?
So what are some of the challenges? I wanted to ask you, Claudia, what kind of problems do you experience teaching young learners?
Well, actually, we have a lot of children having issues with attention because, you know, nowadays we are facing the technology era. We try to engage our students with a lot of activities that we know they are interested in. For example, sometimes we try to talk about something that they like to do. And also we try a lot of physical activities. You know, for someone who is not paying attention, it is important to focus their mind and their bodies in the same place. That's why, in my case, I use a lot of movement in my class.
I see. And that keeps their attention.
Yes. After that, they already have their attention. I can use that time, maybe 5 minutes after, to say the most important part of my class so that I can give all the content in that part.
I see. So it's about keeping their attention. And I read this interesting quote from a children's course book writer, Nicholas Horsburgh, He says teachers should continuously introduce new methodologies in teaching so as to make learning a more stimulating and pleasurable experience for children. By new methodologies, I imagine that means that, you know, you're applying a range of approaches to the way you teach, say, grammar or speaking, and the new methodology would inform the structure of the lesson. Does that sound about right to you?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that we already, probably without knowing, use a few different methodologies and approaches in our classes anyway. But one of the best things about working in a school or working in a language school is that there are other teachers there and a wealth of other experience to draw from. And if you can pick up something new, a new technique, a new way of teaching any type of skill or language point, then I think you should try and build it into your class.
And actually, this is aimed at engaging children, but really, as a teacher, using new methodologies or experimenting or trying new things is going to keep you engaged as much as anything else.
Absolutely.
Because you have to teach the same things again and again.
Yeah, I think it applies to everyone, doesn't it, across the board. But yes, yeah, specifically with children, I suppose it's definitely worth bearing in mind. Even what Sean was talking about earlier, narrative contextualization. I mean, if you do that once a week, surely that would be such a fun thing to happen, and it would really benefit the class.
I think we're very fortunate now that people have done so much research and so much trialing of these different methodologies in class that we're able to select which ones we like and how we want to use them, depending on what the situation in our own personal kind of teaching is.
Okay, so let me play bad cop here. Are there any downsides to this? Is there anything bad about continuously introducing new teaching techniques?
Well, possibly by having too much of a mixture, you run the risk of alienating your students. And it's good when there's a structure and there's no surprises and people can focus on what's being taught. You know, familiarity is good and it sets boundaries for the classroom. What do you think, Claudia?
Well, I think, yeah, we have to help students to involve into changes. And for me, it's okay to make changes in class.
Yeah, I think children are very open to that, much more so than us adults.
I would say, though, that I think that routines are the bedrock of a successful primary class. So if you have set routines for classroom management, for beginning and ending classes, then I don't think you should alter those, just depending on what the content of the class is after that.
I'm so glad you said that, because actually when I was teaching children, I had really structured lessons, and they were essentially the same structure every time. The games or the activities or, you know, the songs and that kind of thing would change.
But yeah, you'd swap things
in
and out.
I did things at the same time every lesson.
And that was good.
I mean, it worked for me, but I don't know if the children liked it.
Yeah, it worked for them. Yeah, I think most teachers would get on board with what Nicholas is suggesting and at least have a go to see how their students respond. I think anything which can help to refresh or change the dynamic of the classroom has to be a good thing, right?
Agreed. Okay, great. Yes. So teachers, over to you. Have you ever tried narrative contextualization? Do you make an effort to regularly introduce new methodologies? Leave a comment on the One Stop page or email us at onestoppodcast@springernature.com. Okay, next up, it's Warmer of the Month. Each month, we challenge our guest teacher to explain a fun, communicative activity in no more than 5 steps. So, Claudia, what have you got for us?
Well, today I have an activity that is a warmer, and it is a brain gym. It is a workout for the body and brain. The first thing is to put some lively music and get the students to follow the teacher's instruction, and then the movement that the teacher is going to show to the students. For example, first you have to touch your knees using the crisscross, one arm into the in one knee and the other arm into the other knee. Then touch your shoulders, touch your ears, and finally you have to touch your nose. So the students can have a movement in their own bodies, but also their brain is working too. This gets the students active in their body and their mind in a very funny way, because also the music helps them to have a better environment in class.
Right, so it's a nice fun way to get them warmed up mentally and physically at the beginning of the class.
Yes, of course. And the, it works for very young students and also for their higher levels. Mm.
Yeah.
They love to do it.
Okay, great. And Claudia, yeah. you had another exercise, didn't you? Something about vocabulary.
Yes, of course. In our case, that we have a bilingual class, it's very important to introduce the vocabulary into students. So we use different abilities for this kind of activity. The first one that I really like to do is, for example, the social ability. In this part, we can use the strategy to split the class into groups or pairs or maybe trios. We can let them choose their partner. You know, that could be a free activity in order to make the group. Then we can make the students come up with a list of words in their native tongue, which they don't know in English.
Okay.
So this part is very fun because we can use different tools. The next thing that we can do is this is also two chance to get them started using a dictionary. We can use dictionary or we also have the technology. You know, we can use a dictionary online or we can use dictionaries in a physical production as a book. And also you can give the students a list of new words to find. So we can do like a challenge. You know, you can say the team that finished first is going to have 3 minutes of free work or free time. So it's very challenging for them and they are very enthusiastic at working this way.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much, Claudia. Okay, let's move on to this month's interview. In this, the first of a two-part interview, Patrick talks to Carol Reed about the challenges of writing for young learners and how to be a highly effective teacher.
Okay, good morning, Carol. How are you?
Hi, Patrick. I'm fine. It's boiling here in Madrid today.
Good stuff, good stuff. Okay, so I wanted to kick things off with a fairly straightforward question. What do you think, in your experience, are the main challenges of writing course books for young learners?
That's a good question. I think, first of all, the term young learners needs to be a little bit defined because in different contexts, that can mean any child between the age of 3 and 18. So I think it's helpful to break the term down into age-related stages that correspond to children's experience at school. So, for example, to talk about pre-primary or early years, lower and upper primary, lower and upper secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking particularly of primary, that's already a big age span from about 6 to 12. So I think one of the first challenges is to create a concept and develop materials that grow up with the children. Children at 6 and 12 are at very different stages of social, psychological, emotional, physical, cognitive and conceptual development. And so a course book of 6 levels needs to reflect this, not only in terms of topics and content, but also in terms of activity types and procedures that are used. And in terms of language, as children go older, there needs to be a move from an implicit acquisitional approach towards natural everyday language chunks to actually encouraging children to notice language patterns as they develop the cognitive skills to do that and to adopt a more explicit and also, of course, child-friendly approach to grammar. I think related to this, another key challenge is to ensure the emotional, social, and cognitive engagement of children from the outset and to give them the confidence and competence to use English in ways that are purposeful, relevant, and meaningful to them right from the start. You know, children don't usually have any extrinsic reason for learning English, apart from their parents who told them it's a good thing.
Mm.
And so creating intrinsic motivation through materials that are appealing and interesting in their own right is essential. And this means, for example, when using activities such as stories, which are often found in children's course books these days, these need to be genuinely well-constructed stories with a problem or conflict and resolution, and not just the situation masquerading as a story, which is then used as a vehicle for language practice. Children quickly see through that and it turns them off. I think another key challenge is in balancing a holistic approach which takes into account all aspects of children's development, and balancing that with a carefully graded and sequenced syllabus and systematic approach that lays the foundations for future learning and also ensures that children pass any internal or external tests and exams that they may have to do, something which is in many contexts but increasingly common. And I think this balance can be achieved in a number of ways. For example, by including on the one hand a strong element of personalization activities, or of learning activities that involve collaboration and choice through, for example, projects, as well as a focus on thinking skills such as creative and critical thinking, cross-curricular links, culture and values education on the one hand, for example, and including activities and games that make use of techniques such as information gap for practicing specific language points in a motivating and meaningful way, and also scaffolding skills work, particularly reading and writing, so that micro skills are built up progressively and in a coherent and logical way. When designing and sequencing activities, I like to think of the process as the links in a chain, that each link builds on and consolidates what's come before, as well as preparing for what's to follow. And so the children experience a smooth learning experience, but actually this is underpinned by very careful scaffolding. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that teachers should never be slaves to course books, but rather the other way around. At the same time, when I write a course book, my bottom line is that the materials will work, in inverted commas, for anyone who follows the guidelines and instructions. So I think another key challenge is to create materials that will work for you if you follow the teacher's book, but which at the same time are not prescriptive and will also allow for freedom and flexibility to use the materials in other ways too. And I think this freedom and flexibility lies in suggesting options and alternatives and opening up rather than closing down possibilities. And recently, for example, I've also found that writing a blend of print and digital materials can offer a great deal of variety and flexibility depending on how much teachers want to use technology or how easily available it is.
Okay. Well, you said there's a lot of support for teachers in terms of teachers' notes in your books, and obviously that's very important. But you gave a talk quite recently, and the title was Reflections on How to Be a Highly Effective Teacher. So aside from teachers' notes, what tips can you give to our listeners on becoming the most effective teacher they can be?
Right. Yeah. As part of that talk, I actually developed something I call a reflective teacher wheel that has 8 ingredients for becoming the most effective teacher you can be. And it's actually on my website if listeners are interested in following it up. But I think I'd probably highlight 3 things from that. The first thing would be developing a positive mindset, both in ourselves as teachers and in our learners. And for ourselves, I think it's important for us to remember that we have choice in the way that we think, and that we need to develop a mindset, attitude and awareness that will help us to be the best teacher we can be. This is very much drawing on the work of John Hattie, who argues that the most successful teachers believe that they are agents of change. They actually believe that they have the qualities and skills that can make a difference to their students' lives. And the belief of teachers that the outcomes for children are not fixed and that we can change and influence them is crucial to successful teaching. I'm thinking of mindsets for learners. I'm thinking, obviously, of things like critical thinking and creative thinking, but I'm thinking particularly of the development of a growth mindset as opposed to a fixed mindset. And I'm sure a lot of listeners will recognise that this comes from the research work by Professor Carol Dweck into essentially the underpinnings of human motivation and how people persevere after setbacks, why some people give up and why others who are no more skilled keep on trying. And Dweck sees that one answer lies in people's beliefs about why they have failed. And these are very often built up and communicated by teachers and, of course, by parents as well, through the kind of praise and feedback that they get. So developing a growth mindset whereby our learners actually have the mindset that their intelligence can be developed through effort and hard work. If you like, that they're mastery-oriented rather than the contrast with a fixed mindset where our learners, our children, believe that intelligence is something that you either have or don't have. And if they can't do something, they feel it's because they're not intelligent enough. So when our praise and feedback focuses on intelligence or talent, we just say, oh, that's great, that's a brilliant piece of work. It's likely to promote a fixed mindset. And so we need to use process praise or descriptive praise and comment specifically on the effort, strategies, focus, and persistence in the face of difficulty, or the kind of willingness to take on challenges that our children show, which is likely to lead to a growth mindset. So that's one thing. Another area I would mention is the working really hard at developing relationships with students and with the people that you teach. And a relationship or state of having trust and mutual responsiveness with others. And what it means is that you respond to learners and give them the experience of being understood. And of course, all of us have our own individual unique teaching persona and need to do this in ways which come naturally to our own individual personalities. But we can also use specific strategies and techniques. And a quote that I often share with teachers is one that comes from Veronica De Andres. And she says that children don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So we need to, as teachers, create individual rapport with our students, finding out about and showing interest in them in moments before and after lessons, doing individual work, and also genuinely listening to what students have to say in personalised learning activities. But also we need to develop group rapport, and there are many different techniques for doing this. For example, activities that get learners to explore similarities with their peers, or activities that synchronise breathing and movement, such as action songs. And I always love that quote from Maya Angelou, where she says something like, if I'm getting it right, I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And actually, the relationship side of things is so important. And the third thing I'd mention is something that's already come up before, actually, is engagement. You know, the starting point of everything for us as teachers is having children's engagement. Without engagement, nothing else is possible. It's a bit like, you know, the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And some of the key factors in engagement are curiosity, of course, stimulating curiosity, and through questions, riddles, predictions, what happens next in the story, through making learning relevant. Is it valuable? Is it useful? Is it worthwhile? The what's in it for me factor. Establishing clear, worthwhile, and attainable goals that children can relate to. Providing an appropriate level of challenge, for example, as well. And also ensuring that our children have the competence, the necessary skills and strategies to do what we ask them to do. It obviously has to be at an appropriate level of challenge, but a feeling of can do rather than can't do. I think also, as part of engagement, feedback is an integral part of the process. How am I doing? How can I do better? It needs to be constructive and encouraging, and it needs to be integrated, not just something that happens at the end of a unit of work or the end of term. Another thing that is really important is offering children choice, giving them a feeling of autonomy, responsibility, increasing their sense of ownership because they've chosen to do something. And that can be a micro choice, as simple as, you know, the colours I use in a picture or how I present a project, or they can be more macro to do with actually, you know, the topic of work that we're going to embark on. And I think, of course, engagement, enjoyment is inevitably a part of it as well, that there is an element of humour and fun, although that's definitely not by itself sufficient. And I think also worth mentioning in this context is Csikszentmihalyi's concept of flow, that sense of being fully involved in whatever you're doing, your emotions positively harnessed to the task in hand. And I think one other thing that I would mention in relation to engagement is actually communicating and sharing your own passion for language and learning, that actually children will mirror the teacher's enthusiasm and tackle challenges of learning with more resilience and enthusiasm.
Well, that's it for part one. The second part of the interview, in which Carol talks about creativity in the classroom and her award-winning title, 500 Activities for the Primary Classroom, is available separately on the podcast page. Okay, next up is teacher tips. Each month we probe our guest teacher for professional advice. So Claudia, what's your number one tip for a new young learner teacher?
Well, the tips that I have for the teachers are, the first is, it is really important to be empathic with the students, but it is important to find out how the students felt, ask them to give you thumbs up for I love it, or I learned lots and feel good, or horizontal thumbs for it's okay, but not the best, and thumbs down for I'm not happy, it could be better. It is really important to let the students show their feelings and show them that they can be free in the way that they are feeling in our class. It's very important also to make them feel comfortable in our own class, like if they were in their own houses.
Brilliant. Okay, a good piece of advice. Thanks very much. All right, it's Q&A time on the One Stop Podcast, the part of the show in which we try to answer your questions. You guys ready?
Oh, yes.
Ready?
Okay. Question number one. What are some good strategies for classroom management with young learners? Any ideas, anyone?
Well, we already spoke about routines. I'd also say giving out different responsibilities to the learners and giving them each their own personal responsibility really, really helps in terms of classroom management. And that's something that you can put up on the chart, on the wall, or put up on the board, and you can alternate or change however much you want. But there'll be a book monitor, a paper monitor, a line monitor, etc., etc. And someone, if you give the children that responsibility, then it automatically increases the level of classroom management, I find, rather than being teacher-centered.
That's interesting. Yeah, I had a similar-ish idea, which was really you just have a list of the students on the board and had pictures of the students. And when they do something good or win a game or something like that, you award them a star. And if they do something that is not so good or you don't like, then you remove a star.
Mm.
And it's really like a student of the month competition, essentially. So you can do it student of the week, and you can have prizes if you like, or it depends on the age. Sometimes they were just happy to come top and to line up first to leave the classroom. So it just depends on the age. All right, next up, the age-old dilemma. How can we encourage students to study more outside of the classroom? Claudia?
Well, I think it is like the answers they give in the last question is to make them feel engaged.
Yeah.
whenever they feel engaged with the class, it's not difficult for them to study out of the classroom. Also, they use their self-control, and they will know how to manage and how to work out of the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good tips, really. So really inspire them to go and work outside of the class. Okay, and finally, what is the most rewarding thing about teaching young learners? Claudia, what do you think? What's the most rewarding thing?
Their love.
Their love.
So for me, their love. Yeah. Because, you know, young learners, they know how to show gratitude. And they know how to show whenever they feel comfortable with you, whenever they feel engaged with you and your class. And they really show in a very loving way. That's why I think the most rewarding thing about teaching for young learners is that, is their love. And the second thing, I think it's their advance during the school year. Mm. Whenever you see their goals that they are achieving every month, you can congratulate them, but also congratulate you because you are doing a great job.
Right. So seeing that kind of progress is really rewarding in itself.
Yes, exactly. That is one of the most rewarding things about teaching your learners.
Yeah, I agree with you definitely, Claudia. I think you can see results so quickly, so much quicker than sometimes with older students. And it's fun. It's just
Absolutely.
Fun.
Yeah,
it's just a whole lot of fun.
I would just add that energy. You can go into a young learner class feeling tired and you'll come out feeling revitalized after teaching them sometimes.
Well, that seems like a good place to finish this section. Okay, that's it for another month. If you have any questions, suggestions or feedback, please email us at onestoppodcast@springandnature.com or leave a comment on the One Stop page. Thanks to our in-house panelists, Becca and Sean.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks to our guest teacher this month, Claudia Salazar, for joining us all the way from Mexico.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And thank you for listening. And until next month, this is the One Stop English Podcast.